Our fourth plenary session is going to look at the whole area of the Napoleonic Wars and Baptist response, particularly in England, to the Napoleonic Wars, and I'm assuming primarily through the writings of Andrew Fuller. And it's going to be given to us by Dr. Paul Brewster. Dr. Brewster hails from Arkansas, did his PhD at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary on Andrew Fuller, so he knows Fuller very well. And that has been published by Broadman and Holman as Andrew Fuller, Pastor Theologian. And if you didn't pick up a copy, you should pick up a copy. It's a tremendous study of the applicability of Fuller's life and ministry to pastoral life and pastoral ministry. Currently, Dr. Brewster is pastoring in Madison, Indiana, at Rikers Ridge Baptist Church. And he's going to come now and speak about Andrew Fuller and the war against Napoleon.
Thank you, Michael. Michael indicated that I'm a native Arkansan, and I am Michael's connection to hillbilly culture. I've been trying to convert him to that. I don't know that I've had a lot of success in that regard. What? You're from Arkansas as well? Oh, okay, on the hill culture side of things. Well, if you looked over the schedule, it has occurred to me that I may be a representative of affirmative action in work because I'm the only pastor, I believe, on the schedule today. So, you know, if you're interested in that angle, if you'll just apply to Michael, maybe next year, if you're here as a pastor, he can pick you up in that regard. The era of the Napoleonic Wars was one of the true watershed epochs in the history of Western civilization. As such, it transformed many facets and institutions of European society, including church, state, and military. Beyond the institutional changes spawned by two decades and more of conflict, the prevailing attitudes of the people also underwent a radical transformation. As nationalism took root, patriotism grew and flowered. In traditionally Christian countries like Britain, patriotism and piety became closely linked. Some measure of the attitudes of British Baptists to war during this pivotal time can be formed by looking at the writings of Andrew Fuller, who lived from 1754 to 1815. Fuller was at the peak of his influence among Baptists at exactly the same time that Britain was engaged in her death duel with Napoleon. As such, his sermons, his published writings, and his unpublished correspondence are important sources that reflect Baptist responses to war in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, especially in England. Start with a word about revolutionary France. Revolutionaries in France discovered that toppling the Ancien regime, that's Arkansas for that French word, toppling that was considerably easier than administering a new republic, on top of the difficulties inherent in a complete upheaval of French society. They soon had to face the backlash of the joint military ventures of the great monarchical powers, who saw the seeds of their own demise writ large in the collapse of the French monarchy. As the situation in the young French Republic grew more and more desperate societally, economically, and militarily, an ambitious young Corsican, Napoleon Bonaparte, seemed able to exploit every new crisis to his advantage. For a time, he maintained the veneer of a republic, taking on himself the title of First Consul and ruling under the auspices of a new constitution. But by 1804, France had a new supreme monarch, as Napoleon famously crowned himself Emperor Napoleon I in a ceremony at Notre Dame that rivaled all the pomp and ceremony that the House of Bourbon could have mustered. From 1792 to Napoleon's final defeat at Waterloo in 1815, a kaleidoscope of coalitions battled him militarily in the field, fought France for economic control of Europe, and waged an ideological war for the hearts and minds of men. While other nations in these coalitions changed like the seasons, The one constant enemy throughout this time was Great Britain. And she remained in open warfare with France for all these years, with the brief exception of about 14 months, during which the Treaty of Amiens was essentially in effect. Over two decades of war, during which Great Britain was under more or less constant threat, gave rise to a new national solidarity in England. The world is watching. Though British society in the late 18th and early 19th centuries was still mostly rural and agricultural, many of her citizens had access to news of the world. That meant that the political and military developments were increasingly something that they needed to process through the lens of their Christian faith. Although he lived and ministered in the relative obscurity of a Northamptonshire village, Fuller obviously was a careful student of the newspapers. Consider these following examples, which illustrate the degree to which he was informed about and interested in world affairs. The first one is from a letter he wrote to William Carey in 1794. Fuller said, "Public affairs wear a dark aspect to the political eye, but to the eye of faith it is otherwise. In France, the mountain man, the mountain or Marat party are uppermost. They have guillotined almost all the rest. Brissot and his party were 21 of them guillotined last October. The mountain party are desperate men, but perhaps none but such men could carry things through. Their arms last summer and winter have been almost everywhere victorious. I reckon there will be no more campaigns worth the name. The combined powers are about done over. Old Catherine is a baggage." Catherine of Russia. I'm not quite certain what it means to call a woman a baggage, but I can't imagine it was a complimentary term. "She talked all along, but never meant to do anything. She looked on while Prussia and Austria and England were weakening themselves and had reserved her strength to obtain the Turkish Empire without interruption from them, at which her mouth has been watering for years and against which she is now on the eve of declaring war. Prussia has had enough with France and is said to have declared off. We've sent our fleets to take Domingo and French West India Islands. A dark cloud hangs over us. We expect the French will shortly attempt to invade us. They have been making preparations for it for several months. Great numbers are going to America. Dr. Priestley and 80 and 90 families went this month." A few years later, writing in 1797 this time, Fuller did not think the scene had brightened much. He wrote again, "Things at present look dark with us as a nation. Perhaps that saying may be verified with respect to those who have declined missions through fear, and you who have engaged in them. He that saveth his life shall lose it, and he that loses his life for my sake shall find it. The French have now made peace with all Europe but us, and have subdued almost all Europe to their will. They are threatening us with an invasion in the most violent and outrageous language. I can compare them to nothing but a raving mad bull on the other side of the river. I believe that the French government, from the fall of Robespierre till about 6 months ago, was as good as ought to be expected on this subject. But from that time, another Robespierrean faction has gained the ascendancy. It was pretended that a plot was in agitation to restore royalty and that Pichegru was at the head of it. All of a sudden, that general and 60 or 70 members of the legislature and two of the five directors were seized and banished without trial. I believe at that time and now more firmly believe that the plot was a pretense, that the whole originated in Bonaparte's jealousy of Pichegru and every other popular general in France, and a determination to ruin them, lest they should stand in the way of his designs." End quote. The newspaper had brought the affairs of the world to the attention of average men like Fuller, and pastors like Fuller now found it necessary to help their people apply the scripture to the many questions that this explosion of information raised, including how should they think about war, the threat of invasion. Notice that in both 1794 and 1797, the threat of a French invasion of Britain was uppermost in Fuller's mind. It was, no doubt, on the mind of his congregants as well, for this topic frequently found its way into the British newspapers. Sensationalism in these reports was stock in trade, complete with fanciful pen and ink drawings of all sorts of French secret weapons, from aerial invasions by a non-existent fleet of balloons, to enormous warships, to even an imaginary channel tunnel. The threat, however, was real enough. France unsuccessfully attempted to land expeditionary forces in Ireland in late 1796. In 1797, a French legion, composed mostly of convicts, did manage a beachhead on Wales and hung on for 3 days before being forced to surrender. Those efforts were mostly designed to harass and to stir up trouble for Britain at home by playing on the animosities of annexed peoples. Instead, they tended to galvanize British support for the increasingly costly war against France. After Horatio Nelson and the British Navy devastated the French fleet at the Battle of the Nile in 1798, effectively stranding Napoleon's army in Egypt, the First Consul began to lay plans for a serious invasion effort. He realized at that point that his designs in Europe would never be allowed to go forward unless he neutralized the threat of Britain. Napoleon created an army that varied at different times, but up to 200,000 men, which were to be single-mindedly dedicated to the task of conquering Britain. They were known as the Army of the Ocean Coasts, or the Army of England. He garrisoned his troops near the English Channel and spent years training them and supplying them for an invasion that would never come. However, their proximity to the English coast meant that their presence was literally visible to portions of the English populace. This palpable threat to what we would call today homeland security further fanned the flames of patriotism in England. The British responded to Napoleon's threats by strengthening her coastal defenses and by an all-out mobilization of her citizens. At the heart of the coastal defenses was a series of fortresses, the Martello Towers, which sprung up like mushrooms along the Channel Rim. By the way, I understand there are a few of them for sale at present, and you can convert one to a lodge. Their presence stood as a reminder to coastal residents of the pressing French danger. Even more disruptive to the local populace, coastal land was flooded to create quagmires should the French legions dare a landing. And most distressing of all, recruits for the British Armed Forces were demanded in unheard-of numbers from every county and town. The French had pioneered in mobilization by levée en masse, and those nations that sought to oppose Napoleon's aggression had to resort to much broader means of recruiting than ever before. Of course, as the ranks of British soldiers and sailors swelled, so did the cost to the crown of training and equipping and deploying them. Every British citizen was reminded their nation was in a state of war as they struggled to pay the numerous taxes and fees which became increasingly burdensome as the war continued with no end in sight. The new reality of total war. The upshot of the preparations was that Britain was very much on a total war footing during the Napoleonic era, especially after the collapse of the Treaty of Amiens. By contrast, the dispute in the New World with the rebellious American colonies had seemed neither threatening nor urgent to most Britons. In fact, the War of the American Revolution was decidedly unpopular in the motherland. British Baptists, in particular, had been surprisingly outspoken in their opposition to the war. John Rippon, the Baptist pastor and chronicler from London, offered this informal analysis of the lack of support. "I believe that all our Baptist ministers in town," meaning London, "except two, and most of the brethren in the country, were on the side of the Americans in the late dispute." A colorful account of British Baptist sentiment on the American war has been preserved, and as it happens, it traces back to men intimately connected with Andrew Fuller and the environs of his ministry. Robert Hall Sr. and John Ryland Sr. This story illustrates that a patriotic outpouring of support for the wars of one's homeland was not always a part of Baptist piety. It was told by Robert Hall, Jr. "Sir, that war, the American Revolutionary War, was very unpopular and considered to be very unrighteous by men of true liberty principles. My father, sir, warmly advocated the American cause. When I was a little boy, he took me to the school of Mr. Ryland in Northampton, the father of Dr. Ryland of Bristol. This Mr. Ryland was very eccentric and a violent partisan of the Americans. It was in the hottest period of the war, sir, and many persons were indignant at the conduct of the English government. That war, sir, was considered a crusade against the liberty of the subject and the rights of man. The first night we arrived at Northampton from Arnsby, sir, the two old gentlemen, my father and Mr. Ryland, talked over American politics until they both became heated on the same side of the question. At length, Mr. Ryland burst forth in this manner, 'Brother Hall, I will tell you what I would do if I were General Washington.' 'Well,' said my father, 'what would you do?' 'Why, Brother Hall, if I were General Washington, I would summon all the American officers, and they would form a circle around me, and I would address them, and we would offer a libation with our own blood, and I would order one of them to bring a lancet and a punch bowl, and he should bleed us all one by one into this punch bowl. And I would be the first to bear my arm. And when the punch bowl was full and we had all been bled, I would call upon every man to consecrate himself to the work by dipping his sword into the bowl and entering into a solemn covenant agreement by oath one to another. And we would swear by him that sits upon the throne and lives forever and ever that we would never sheathe our swords while there was an English soldier in arms remaining in America. That is what I would do, Brother Hall.'" As Hall indicated, Ryland was noted as an eccentric, and he no doubt blustered in this exchange more than he himself might really have felt. But his outburst does underscore the fact that patriotism among Baptists in the 18th century did not necessarily translate into unqualified support for Britain's wars. Andrew Fuller on Christian patriotism. The war against Napoleon was different. France's naked aggression, coupled with the breathtaking success of Napoleon's infantry all across Europe, solidified Baptist support for what eventually came to be seen as a just war of defense. In 1803, during a time when the French invasion seemed imminent, Andrew Fuller delivered a sermon to the Baptist church in Kettering entitled Christian Patriotism. An analysis of this sermon will help reconstruct what I think was probably a typical Baptist perspective on war during this era. By the way, Fuller typically preached exegetically through books of the Bible, and he held at Kettering for most of his ministry three different sermons a day. He had the morning sermon, although he called that, I believe, the forenoon sermon, and then there was the afternoon sermon, and then there was the evening lecture, and he uses the word lecture instead of a sermon. And apparently he might have used those evening sermons for less exegetical work, not going through the books per se, but maybe to deal with a topic like this, to speak on Christian patriotism in order to help his people think about how should we think about this issue in terms of what our Christian faith would lead us to do. And this sermon, by the way, I should also mention, was published. It was published almost immediately after it was delivered. So it would have had a hearing far beyond the merely, you know, 800 or 900 folks that might have been at that church to hear him when he initially delivered it. Fuller began his sermon by acknowledging that how a Christian views his position in a time of war is a difficult issue that requires very careful thought. "In the course of human events," he writes, "cases may be expected to occur in which a serious mind may be at a loss with respect to the path of duty. Presuming, my brethren, that such may be the situation of some of you at this momentous crisis, a crisis in which your country, menaced by an unprincipled, powerful, and malignant foe, calls upon you to arm in its defense. I take the liberty of freely imparting to you my sentiments on the subject. As a long-tenured pastor of Kettering, whose opinions were deeply valued in contemporary particular Baptist circles, even particular evangelical circles, Fuller commanded a position of respect from which to help his people think through the biblical implications of their responsibilities to their country in a time of war. I would mention that Fuller had been pastor by the time he delivered this sermon for about 22 years. One of his biographers very famously described his pastorate there. He said, quote, "He had a bishopric without any of its titles and emoluments. In every case of difficulty, his assistance was required." And as a Southern Baptist, let me just add this for free. One of the well-observed truths about our denomination is that the short tenures we have in our pastorates mitigates against any of us having this kind of influence. None of us are apt to be described, brethren, as bishops, and we are not necessarily as influential as we could be because we do not stay long enough in order for that to be the case. Well, in this sermon, Fuller directed the attention of his hearers to a text in Jeremiah. This text, he explained, was given when a part of the Jewish people were carried captives to Babylon, 10 years or thereabouts before the entire ruin of the city and temple. They must have felt much at a loss in determining upon what was duty. Through Jeremiah, the Lord provided extensive and important guidance. And here was his text. "Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, unto all that are carried away captive, whom I have caused to be carried away from Jerusalem unto Babylon, build ye houses and dwell in them, and plant gardens and eat the fruit of them. Take ye wives and beget sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons, and give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters, that they may be increased there and do not be diminished. And seek the peace of the city whither I have caused you to be carried away captive, and pray unto the Lord for it, for in the peace thereof ye shall have peace." Jeremiah 29:4-7. Granting there were differences between the original setting and the current national crisis, Fuller reasoned that this text had a heightened applicability to British citizens facing Napoleon's threat. He said, "I do not suppose that the case of these peoples corresponds exactly with ours, but the difference is of such a nature as to heighten our obligations. They were in a foreign land, a land where there was nothing to excite their attachment, but everything to provoke their dislike. They had enjoyed all the advantages of freedom and independence, but now they were reduced to slavery." Fuller went on to enumerate some of the privileges they enjoyed as British citizens, which only compounded their obligations to seek their country's welfare in all things. He said, "Now, if such was the duty of men in their circumstances, can there be any doubt with respect to ours? Ought we not to seek the good of our native land, the land of our fathers' sepulchres? A land where we are protected by mild and wholesome laws, administered under a paternal prince, a land where civil and religious freedom are enjoyed in a higher degree than in any country in Europe, a land where God has been known for many centuries as a refuge, a land, in fine, where there are greater opportunities for propagating the gospel, both at home and abroad, than in any other nation under heaven. Need I add to this that the invader," Cyrus he meant, "was to them a deliverer, but to us, beyond all doubt, would be a destroyer." With that introduction, Fuller proceeded to his first point, which was to inquire into the duty of religious people towards their country. He noted that though Christians had been instructed to beware of conforming to the world, it was also a matter of revelation that they had various obligations to the world to which they must attend. Husbands, for example, had certain obligations to their wives and children. And slaves were called to serve their masters with diligence. When it came to matters of civil society, Fuller was on firm scriptural ground when he summed up, "If we were rulers, our country would have a serious claim on us as rulers. And as we are subjects, it has a serious claim upon us as subjects. The manner in which we discharge these relative duties contributes not a little to the formation of our character, both in the sight of God and man." So how a Christian met his obligations to government was seen as an important part of what we would call the sanctification process of the Christian life. Seek the peace of the city. Hearkening back to his text in Jeremiah 29, Fuller identified two scriptural injunctions that summed up the Christian's duty to government. They were to be constantly seeking the peace of the city and praying to the Lord for it. Taking up the first injunction, Fuller rightly noted that the Hebrew word shalom was very comprehensive. It connoted more than an absence of war, but prosperity in general, and meant that the captive exiles were to seek the good or welfare of Babylon in the broadest of terms. Applying that principle to the Christian era, Fuller noted that we ought to be patriots or lovers of our country. Lest that be interpreted to mean that country must be supported in all events, Fuller was quick to add an important qualification. He said, "To prevent mistakes, however, it is proper to observe that the patriotism required of us is not that love of country which clashes with universal benevolence or which seeks its prosperity at the expense of the general happiness of mankind. Such was the patriotism of Greece or Rome, and such is that of all others where Christian principle is not allowed to direct it. The prosperity which we are directed to seek in behalf of our country involves no ill will to anyone except to those who shall attempt to overthrow it." Not content to ignore the elephant in the room, Fuller went ahead and clearly made an application of this stance to the pressing moral issue of his day. He said, "Such, I am ashamed to say, is that with which some have advocated the cause of Negro slavery. They say, it is necessary, forsooth, to the wealth of this country. No, if my country cannot prosper but at the expense of justice, humanity, and the happiness of mankind, let it be unprosperous." Fuller, however, entertained no doubts that Britain could still prosper without slavery. Echoing Proverbs 14:34, he argued that righteousness will be found to exalt a nation and so to be true wisdom. This qualified patriotism involved God's people in no conflict of conscience. There were times when Fuller believed that a citizen could not be supportive of his country. Fuller carefully staked out the position he wished for his congregation to embrace. He said, "Our concern is to cultivate that patriotism which harmonizes with goodwill toward men. When a Christian found his country pursuing a course that ran roughshod over the rights of others, he advocated Christians remember that their first loyalty must remain with God. O my country, I will lament thy faults, yet with all thy faults, I will seek thy good, not only as a Briton, but as a Christian." In expounding how Christians are obligated to seek the peace of their country, Fuller reminded his hearers that we shall certainly do nothing and join in nothing that tends to disturb its peace or hinder its welfare. That would obviously preclude Christian involvement in plots to overthrow the government. But Fuller reached much further in his conclusions. He also applied this principle to a Christian's speech toward the government. He said, "Whoever deals in inflammatory speeches or in any manner sows the seeds of discontent and disaffection. We shall not. Whoever labors to depreciate its governors, supreme or subordinate, in a manner tending to bring government itself into contempt, we shall not. He that can employ his wit in degrading magistrates is not their friend, but their enemy. And he that is an enemy to magistrates is not far from being an enemy to his country. I would remind those of you who are Americans, in this election cycle that we are entering into, there's great wisdom in what Fuller said. Now, Fuller did allow that sometimes a Christian could not stand silently by as his country pursued a path that troubled his conscience. But in that event, he should choose to express disapprobation with respect and regret, for a dutiful son may see a fault in his father, but he will take no pleasure in exposing him. Having concluded that seeking the peace of one's country implied there were some things which Christians should not do, he now turned his attention to the positive implications of this command. Fuller put forward a position that recognized the inherent difficulty of supporting government when party loyalties were in play. He wrote, "It becomes Christians to bear positive goodwill toward their country and to its government, considered as government, irrespective of the political party which may have the ascendancy. We may have our preferences, and that without blame. But they ought never prevent a cheerful obedience to the laws, a respectful demeanor toward those who frame and execute them, or a ready cooperation in every measure which the being or well-being of the nation may require. The civil power, whatever political party is uppermost, while it maintains the great ends of government, ought at all times to be able to reckon upon religious people as its cordial friends. And if such we be, we shall be willing, in times of difficulty, to sacrifice private interest to public good, shall contribute of our substance without murmuring, and, in cases of imminent danger, shall be willing to expose even our lives in its defense. Christian citizenship required that the well-being of the country never be sacrificed to party interests. When it came to matters of national policy affecting decisions like the pursuit of war, Fuller recognized that party rhetoric could easily mislead. Thus, he warned his people to be on guard against it. That warning out of the way, Fuller had now arrived at the heart of the matter he intended to address in his sermon. Was it permissible for Christians to participate in military service? In light of the possible invasion and the increasing demands the crown was making on all communities and counties for conscripts, this question was an urgent one for his congregation. Fuller saw that a part of his pastoral responsibility lay in helping his people think biblically about the issue. I should add that in addition to the recruits for the Navy and for the regular Army, there was a tremendous mobilization of a home guard, a militia sort of movement that trained regularly. And so even those that were not necessarily, you know, in a deployment kind of status with the military, they were having to think and to wrestle about the issue, shall I go drill? Shall I turn out for defense or not? So shall a Christian bear arms? Fuller developed his sermon by expounding the grounds upon which he believed military service could be construed as an obligation of Christian citizenship. The first observation Fuller made in this regard was to remind his hearers of the example of Abraham. When the patriarch received word that Lot and his family had been plundered and kidnapped into slavery, he did not hesitate in launching a military reprisal. The text of Genesis in no way casts this action in a negative light. In fact, it highlights Abraham's military skill and his bravery. Moreover, Melchizedek seems to speak for God when he blessed Abraham at the conclusion of the hostilities, going so far as to attribute the patriarch's success to the direct hand of God. Quote, blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thine hand. Genesis 14. Fuller anticipated that some critics might complain that his chosen example was from the Old Testament, and that it had somehow been superseded by Jesus' instruction not to resist evil. He put forth the strongest case for non-resistance to evil that he could imagine by recounting that awful night in Gethsemane on which Jesus was arrested. Jesus rebuked Peter's aggression that night by telling him to sheath his sword and by speaking the memorable words, "For all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword." Matthew 26. How then can Christians justify armed resistance? Fuller argued that a single event in Scripture does not always translate into a universal principle to guide our actions. He said, "Christianity, I allow, is a religion of peace, and wherever it universally prevails in the spirit and power of it, wars will be unknown, but so will every other species of injustice. Yet, while the world is as it is, some kind of resistance to injustice is necessary, though it may at some future time become unnecessary. If our Savior's command that we resist not evil be taken literally and universally, it must have been wrong for Paul to have remonstrated against the magistrates at Philippi, and he himself would not have reproved the person who smote him at the judgment seat." It appears that Fuller's selections are less than apt, for in neither instance mentioned does the Apostle Paul resort to armed resistance. However, his broader hermeneutical conclusion appears to be sound. Jesus' rebuke of Peter's actions in Gethsemane seems to be a slender thread from which to suspend a thoroughgoing policy of pacifism and non-resistance. Fuller takes pain to distinguish between what a Christian might do when acting in an individual capacity and in what he might do when acting as a member of a civil society. Though Peter had been forbidden to use the sword to defend his master, Fuller accepted that there may be extreme cases in which even an individual has a right to use deadly force in resistance to evil. He said, "I allow that the sword is the last weapon to which we should have recourse. As individuals, it may be lawful by this instrument to defend ourselves or our families against the attacks of an assassin. But perhaps this is the only case in which it be so. And even there, if it were possible to disarm and confine the party, it were much to be chosen than in that manner to take away his life." Lest he be misunderstood, Fuller clarified that this possible justification for an individual to use force was extremely limited in scope. For example, it did not warrant Christians using force to defend their supposedly offended sense of honor. Such activities, e.g. dueling, may be considered honorable in that strata of society which Fuller called, quote, the high life, but they are certainly, he said, in direct opposition to the laws of Christ. Even more restricting, Fuller also did not believe that Christians, when acting at individuals, had a biblical justification for defending themselves against persecution for the gospel's sake. No weapon, he said, is admissible in this warfare but truth, whatever the consequences. Now, Fuller was aware that this limitation could have dire repercussions for the faithful in certain circumstances. Indeed, he reminded his hearers that the bloody trail of persecution was traceable almost up to his own time. But he defended the premise that, quote, when Christians have resorted to the sword in order to resist persecution for the gospel's sake, as did the Albigenses, the Bohemians, the French Protestants, and some others within the last 600 years. The issue commonly has been they have perished by it. By contrast, in cases where their only weapons have been the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony, not loving their own lives unto death, they have overcome. Like Israel and Egypt, the more they have been afflicted, the more they have increased. But Fuller went on to explain that the restrictions which should rightly restrain the individual Christian from embracing armed resistance, or even from groups of Christians seeking to protect their churches or their people, did not apply to matters of civil defense. Quote, "But none of these things prove it unlawful to take up arms as members of civil society when called upon to do so for the defense of our country." Fuller believed that although Matthew 26:52 was sometimes used to argue Christians should always opt for non-resistance, when rightly said in its context, it could properly be interpreted as providing a positive rationale for the qualified use of force. Listen to his reasoning. Quote, "The ground on which our Savior refused to let his servants fight for him, that he should not be delivered into the hands of the Jews, was that his kingdom was not of this world, plainly intimating that if his kingdom had been of the world, a contrary line of conduct would have been proper. Now this is what every other kingdom is. It is right, therefore, according to our Lord's reasoning, that the subjects of all civil states should, as such, when required, fight for defense of them." End quote. Fuller linked a series of biblical statements into a chain, which he believed clinched his argument that there were times when the path of duty compelled a Christian to take up arms. Appealing to Paul's argument in Romans 13, Fuller reasoned by asking a series of rhetorical questions. "Has not Christianity, I ask, in the most decided manner, recognized civil government by requiring Christians to be subject to it? Has it not expressly authorized the legal use of the sword? Christians are warned that the magistrate beareth not the sword in vain," Romans 13:1, "and that he is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil," 13:4. "But if it be right for the magistrate to bear the sword and to use it upon evildoers within the realm, it cannot be wrong to use it in repelling invaders from without. And if it be right on the part of the magistrate, it is right that the subject should assist him in it. For otherwise, his power would be merely nominal, and he would indeed bear the sword in vain." The final point Fuller offered to bolster his argument was an observation that the general tenor of the New Testament toward soldiering as a profession was neutral or even positive. Quote, "If the use of arms were of itself and in all cases inconsistent with Christianity, it were a sin to be a soldier. But nothing like this is held out to us in the New Testament. On the contrary, we there read of two believing centurions, and neither of them was reproved on account of his office or required to relinquish it." Fuller also considered the exchange between John the Baptist and some soldiers who came to him asking how their profession impacted the repentance which the prophet had said was necessary to prepare for the advent of God's kingdom. This would have provided the perfect place for Scripture to have indicated that the military profession was incompatible with Christian discipleship. Fuller directed his hearers to consider Luke 3:14. "Some soldiers were questioning him, saying, 'And what about us? What shall we do?' And he said to them, 'Do not take money from anyone by force, or accuse anyone falsely, and be content with your wages.'" While soldiers, like tax collectors, who had asked a similar question at the same time, were warned against the abuses of their respective employments, The employments themselves are tacitly full of rights acknowledged to be lawful. Even though this constituted an argument from silence, Fuller felt it had great force. He said if either of these occupations, soldiering or tax collecting, had been in itself sinful or inconsistent with that kingdom which it was John's grand object to announce, and into the faith of which his disciples were baptized, he ought, on this occasion, to have said so, or to at least not to have said that which implies the contrary. So what of then the issue of conscientious objection? In the heart of his sermon, Fuller believed he had demonstrated that the biblical injunction that we seek the peace of the city to which we are attached implied it was a positive duty for Christians to render military service when called upon to do so by the country as a part of the common defense. At the same time, he was clearly concerned that he not be seen to be giving a blanket endorsement to Christian participation in the armed services. He sought to stake out a position which advocated that military service for believers was compatible with those causes that could be considered just. Fuller anticipated that some might object that no war could ever be considered truly just, for the motivation of the governing parties are almost never completely pure. Against that particular objection, he argued that weighing the motivations of leaders, which might include elements of revenge, greed, national prejudice, or cruelty, was no part of the evaluation process Christians should undergo. Rather, he instructed that in ascertaining the justice or injustice of war, we have nothing to do with the motives of those who engage in it. The question is whether it is in itself unjust. Motivations all aside, Fuller also anticipated that many in his congregation might feel inadequate to judge rightly the justice of a particular cause. Starting with an everyday situation that his hearers could grasp, Fuller reasoned to the weightier situation of international conflict. He wrote, "If a difference arise only between two families or two individuals, though every person in the neighborhood may be talking and giving his opinion upon it, yet it is easy to perceive that no one of them is competent to pronounce upon the justice or the injustice of either side till he has acquainted himself with all the circumstances of the case by patiently hearing it on both sides. How much less then are we able to judge the differences of nations, which are generally not a little complex, both in their origins and bearing, and of which we know but little, but through the channel of newspapers and vague reports." Fuller exhibited a broad willingness to defer to the decisions of the governing authorities in these matters. He said, "Where those who are constitutionally appointed to judge in such matters have decided in favor of war, however painful it may be to my feelings, as a friend of mankind, I consider it my duty to submit and to think well of their decision, till, by a careful and impartial examination of the grounds of the contest, I am compelled to think otherwise." He did not, however, completely subordinate the individual's conscience to the desires of the state. Fuller reserved a very important right of private judgment to the individual believer. If asked to participate in a war which one felt to be unjust, Fuller advised that the Christian, quote, stand aloof from it as far as possible. Though he did not use the term, it seems he is essentially advocating for the possibility of a conscientious objector status. He did not pursue the ramifications which might be expected to follow such a decision. Presumably, he would have advocated a passive acceptance of any civil consequences which might befall the conscientious objector. I listened with interest to Dr. Cross earlier. I believe he used that term, passive resistance. That seems to be the same idea that Fuller would have had, though he didn't flesh that out. Fuller concluded the first major section of his sermon by applying his reasoning to the present scenario facing England. He said, "After all, there may be cases in which the injustice may wear so prominent a feature that every thinking and impartial mind shall be capable of perceiving it. And where it does so, the public sense of it will and ought to be expressed. In the present instance, however, there seems to be no ground of hesitation. In arming to resist a threatened invasion, we merely act on the defensive, and not to resist an enemy whose ambition, under the pretense of liberating mankind, has caused desolation wherever he has gone, were to prove ourselves unworthy of the blessings we enjoy. Without taking upon me to decide on the original grounds of the difference, the question at issue with us is it right that any one nation should seek absolutely to ruin another, and that other not be warranted and even obliged to resist it? That such is the object of the enemy at this time cannot reasonably be doubted." Fuller thus sounded a clear note to his congregants that they could fight Napoleon and maintain a good conscience before God and men at the same time. Put another way, patriotism and piety were completely compatible. His second major portion was pray for the city. In Jeremiah 29:7, the prophet had given a second biblical injunction. God's people were instructed not only to seek the welfare of the city, which Fuller had interpreted in broad terms to mean to include defending her militarily when called upon to do so, but the prophet had also instructed that they were to pray unto the Lord for it. Whereas Fuller had taken 6 pages to cover the implications of seeking the peace of the city, he had to content himself to less than a page for the present section. By the way, Fuller preached extemporaneously with very, very few notes, and I think he suffered the common problem of most of us who do that week in and week out. As he preached, the first section got longer, and he looked down and he realized, I got to wrap this thing up. And so it's a very unbalanced sermon. It wouldn't do well in homiletics class at all, that all the emphasis is on the first point and there's just this little tag on the second. But he did briefly make 2 points. First, he reminded his congregation of the folly of trusting in military strength and not God. He said, "You are aware that all our dependence as a nation is upon God, and therefore should importune His assistance. After all the struggles for power, you know that in His sight all the inhabitants of the world are reputed as nothing. He doth according to His will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay His hand or say unto Him, What dost thou? Indeed, this has been acknowledged and at times sensibly felt by irreligious characters. But in general, the great body of the nation, it is to be feared, think but little about it. Their dependence is on the arm of flesh." In particular, the temptation to reply upon military prowess was the Achilles heel of the great men who commanded armies and navies. "It may be said without uncharitableness that many of our commanders, both by land and sea, as was said of Cyrus, God hath girded them, though they have not known Him." Fuller made application that our awareness of this misplaced confidence should spur God's people to pray all the more. "But by how much you perceive a want of prayer and dependence on God in your countrymen, by so much more should you be concerned, as much as in you lies, to supply the defect." Second, Fuller believed that nations needed to stand in fear of the judgment of God for their misdeeds. The awareness of that truth, he thought, should be a constant prod to God's people to be interceding for their country. He said, "You are also aware, in some measure, of the load of guilt that lies upon your country, and should therefore supplicate mercy on its behalf. It was not France that England had to fear, but God. Napoleon, after all, was only a vain man with boasting menaces. His schemes and devices can be expected to come to nothing unless our iniquities provoke the Lord to deliver us into his hand. One national sin was of uppermost concern for Fuller in terms of inculcating guilt before God, slavery. He lamented to his people, "When I think, among other things, of the detestable traffic before alluded to, in which we have taken so conspicuous a part and have shed so much innocent blood, I tremble. When we have fasted and prayed, I have seemed to hear the voice of God saying to us, 'Loose the bands of wickedness, undo the heavy burdens, let the oppressed go free and break every yoke.'" Harkening back to the exchange between God and Abram for the fate of Sodom, Fuller held out hope for God's deliverance. Yet, peradventure, for his own name's sake, or from a regard to his own cause, which is here singularly protected, the Lord may hearken to our prayers and save us from deserved ruin. We know that Sodom itself would have been saved if 10 righteous men could have been found in her. Motivations to civic duties. Following the main verbs of Jeremiah 27, seeking and praying, Fuller had expounded the duties he felt a Christian owed to his nation. Very briefly, he turned next to touch upon the, quote, motive by which these duties are enforced. This would be where Jonathan Edwards would say he is now improving upon the text. He had time only for two brief thoughts. First, he noted that God had wisely and mercifully interwoven the interest of mankind as to furnish motives to innumerable acts of justice. What Fuller meant was that when a Christian acted out of self-interest, merely to protect his own life and property, he was also fulfilling his duty to seek the good of his city. Some British citizens who chafed under the increasingly heavy demands the crown made upon the populace for treasure and men had questioned if these sacrifices were only for the benefit of the wealthy classes. Yet Fuller saw that the interests of his own common people were inextricably linked with the fate of England. He wrote, "Yes, if men of opulence lose their property, you will lose your employment. You have also a cottage, perhaps a wife and a family, with whom, amidst all your hardships, you live in love. And would it be nothing to you to see your wife or daughters abused, and you yourself unable to protect them, or even to remonstrate, but at hazard of being thrust through with the bayonet? If no other considerations induce us to protect our country and pray to the Lord for it, our own individual and domestic comfort might suffice." Second, Fuller believed that England's religious freedom would be jeopardized if the French were able to subdue them. He reasoned, "So long we have enjoyed religious liberty in this country that I fear we have become too insensible of its value. At present we worship God without interruption. What we might be permitted to do under a government which manifestly hates Christianity and tolerates it at home only as a matter of policy, we know not." Fuller shared with many of his contemporaries a deep loathing for the Jacobins. He characterized them as unprincipled men who have been laboring to overturn Britain's constitution and men who have a deep-rooted enmity to the religion of Jesus. He prayed, "May the Lord preserve us and every part of the United Kingdom from their machinations." Now, it's interesting if you think, when he was talking about Christians absolutely being forbidden to respond or to retaliate if they were persecuted, even unto the loss of their life, he was speaking of that as the responsibility of Christians as Christians, whether it be an individual believer or whether it be a church. But on the other hand, when it came to fighting for the country to defend religious liberty, he gives a very green light to go ahead. And the rationale that seems to be mine in his distinction is the Christians are not allowed to fight as Christians under the banner of the cross. But it's okay for the nation, for England, to fight as a civil society to protect religious freedom, because he felt there was this inherent link between the religious freedom of Britain and the well-being of his people. So it's a fine line, but it's a very I think, real line that he makes. Christians, as Christians, cannot retaliate or even, you know, defend persecution. But the state ought to, if it has a good common sense about what's best for it. It ought to protect the religious freedom of its own people. Fuller's closing thoughts. Fuller had time only for a few tidbits of application. Recognizing that some of his young men were contemplating volunteering for service, Fuller assured them of congressional support should they, or congregational support should they choose that path. Quote, "I know that it is the intention of several whom I now address freely to offer their services at this important period. Should you, dear young people, be called forth in the arduous contest, you will expect an interest in our prayers. Yes, and you will have it. Every one of us, every parent, wife, or Christian friend, if they can pray for anything, will importune the Lord of hosts to cover your heads in the day of battle." In the closing, Fuller's sermon provides an interesting glimpse into the priority with which Baptists set apart the Lord's Day for religious purposes in the early 19th century. Fuller was concerned that those from his congregation who did join the armed services take advantage of their newly granted right to reserve the Lord's Day for worship. His last word was addressed to that issue. Finally, "It affords satisfaction to my mind to be persuaded that you will avail yourselves to the liberty granted to you of declining to learn your exercise on the Lord's Day. Were you called to resist the landing of the enemy on that day, or any other work of necessity, you would not object to it. But in other cases, I trust you will render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, and to God the things that are God." The Methodists had successfully convinced the Parliament to recently pass a law that granted that the training of the militia would not be done on the Lord's Day. If you objected to that as a believer, you were exempted. In summary, Fuller believed that there were times when a Christian was justified in taking up arms in defense of his country. He stands squarely in the long Christian tradition of support for a just war. In cases when a believer was not convinced that the cause was just, Fuller seems to have advocated allowing for the status of a conscientious objector. The overall impression that Fuller leaves is that of nuanced, even reluctant support for the Christian's participation in armed services. Though not addressed in this sermon, one factor that may have colored his thinking in this regard is the corrupting tendencies he thought were inherent in military service. This area of his thought can be best explored against the backdrop of his experiences with a wayward son who died a member of the Royal Marines. The corrupting tendencies of military service. Fuller's eldest son was named Robert. Though he showed some early inclinations toward the ministry, he never made a public profession of faith. Thus, at the age of 14, he was apprenticed to a businessman and friend of Fuller's in London. Almost immediately, Robert began to exhibit symptoms of instability and a penchant for choosing the wrong company. Though his father tried numerous things to reclaim him to a path of stability and morality, Robert increasingly turned to a dissolute lifestyle, unable to stay long in any employment. In a letter to a friend, Fuller revealed his fears that Robert would turn to the army, which he characterized as, quote, "that sink of immorality." Years later, in another letter to his son, Fuller revealed further the low opinion that he held of the company of soldiers. He said to Robert the year before he died, quote, "My dear son, you had advantages in early life, but being continually in profligate company, you must be debased in mind and in a manner reduced to the state of heathenism." And I would say that from the research I did, Fuller was not alone in that attitude. A gentleman who did some work on the social history of that era, Clive Emsley, states that at that time neither service, Army or Navy, was particularly popular. He says, quote, "The Army was regarded as the repository of scoundrels and outcasts." And Fuller seems to have shared that his son would suffer that fate. Well, at age 16, Fuller's fears were realized when Robert did join the Army. He served on and off again in the Army and the Royal Marines for the rest of his short life. His career there was as checkered and as unstable as had been his civilian life. Among other things, he received the incredible sentence of 350 lashes for desertion. More than once, he begged his father to raise the necessary funds to purchase his release from his terms of service. You could send a substitute for your term of service within British military life at that time. Each time, Fuller complied and tried unsuccessfully to reclaim his son to civilian occupations. From 1798, when Robert first enlisted, until 1809, when he died of illness, which is how most soldiers died, on board the fleet, Andrew Fuller's life was filled with the unique and painful sorrow that only a wayward child can inflict. His prophecy that the army would only mire Robert in sin had been fulfilled beyond his worst imagination. Thus, Fuller had an added reason to caution his congregants against the potential dangers of military service on their spiritual life. I have a footnote I would think it worthy to add here, that apparently Fuller's attitudes on this issue softened somewhat later in life. As conscription pressed more and more rank and file Britons into the military service, Fuller thought that he could see a positive influence taking hold. Several years after he preached the sermon that we've worked through here on Christian patriotism, he wrote in his expositions of Genesis, he said, quote, "Look at our fleets and armies. Did we ever before hear of so many lovely groups of Christian people among them?" He seemed to hold out hope that that sink of immorality had been leavened by the influence of God's people being drafted and volunteering. Conclusion. Andrew Fuller never had to make the choice, but it is clear that he would have made a reluctant warrior. He recognized that God had ordained the use of force as a necessary means for checking the otherwise unlimited progress of evil in a fallen world. Thus, as members of civil society, Christian people must sometimes bear arms and otherwise assist their country in the horrible scourge of war. True patriotism did not consist of unthinking allegiance or blindness to the faults of one's native land, but in fervent prayer for an outpouring of God's mercy on a guilty people. Fuller recognized that politics and war stood in a very close relationship. What he said about politics then, I believe, also describes his attitude toward war. He said, quote, "The political world is a tumultuous ocean. Let those who launch deeply into it heed lest they be drowned in it. Time is short. Jesus spent his in accomplishing a moral revolution in the hearts of men." For Fuller, God's people owed ultimate allegiance to the armies of the Lamb, not to the armies of the crown. I would say, in just kind of wrapping up a thought, Fuller's views on patriotism and piety seem to me to have become almost Baptist boilerplate. I think that what he said carries down, and you hear strains of it. You see the same verses. You see the same kind of argument being used down to this very day. What does strike me as a little bit different within my own perspective as a 20-something plus year Southern Baptist pastor is that Fuller reserved more of a note of caution about necessarily embracing with over-enthusiasm every aspect of military and every military endeavor. And as I was preparing this paper and I was reading through Fuller's thoughts on it, I couldn't help but think to my one experience, my only experience, at a Southern Baptist Convention annual meeting. It was held in some huge coliseum in St. Louis, Missouri, some basketball-type arena. And I believe it was on the first night that we had gathered there. We came in for the evening service. There was this jumbotron with an American flag waving in the background. Patriotic music, God Bless America, all the rest of that. And then all of a sudden, out of the dark rafters of this arena, guys came parachuting down, or they were actually fast roping, I think, is the military technique. And it was a guy from the Coast Guard and a guy from the Marines and a guy from the Army and a guy from the Navy. And they all were there representing the branches of the military. And I tell you, that sort of just wholehearted embrace of militarism, that I do not think would have been at all where Fuller would have stood. I think he had a lot more note of, it's necessary, but let's be careful lest we just overly embrace. And I would also say, as a pastor who has raised apparently a warrior, my own son is in a military career, I struggle with the same thoughts that he did as a father, knowing that if my son will maintain his Christian conviction when he is being trained to become a hard man and to kill people, he will have to work doubly hard to maintain that. And I think Fuller is right on when he says, these issues, brothers, cause us for deep, close thinking. Now, frankly, I think if you have the good fortune to face a military-type decision in an era like Fuller faced, or in an era like the, quote, greatest generation faced, I think you're lucky. I think it's relatively easy to think through the biblical implications of this when a Napoleon is threatening to invade your country, when a Hitler is threatening to overthrow all of Western civilization. I think it's incredibly more difficult to think about that in the era where we are, where we're facing unmanned predator drones that are destroying people by remote control from a center in Houston. When we're talking about an enemy that fights by means of terrorism, these are different issues, and they call for, I think, a thoroughgoing, thoughtful process of how do we help our people think about war in this context. And though I, as a pastor, have preached a few lame sermons myself on the theme, and I ministered to Marines at Camp Lejeune for a number of years, I don't feel like I've ever read the definitive work on that, and there's room, I think, for someone to do a lot of work there. So, Brother Michael.
We do have time for some questions, so.
I think it was both a sincerely held conviction of the respect and the deference that was due to the duly appointed rulers, the magistracy. I think that was definitely part of it. On the other hand, you cannot discount the other issue he was dealing with, you know, that if you guys criticize the crown at a time when we're at war, at a time when correspondence is being opened and they're reading that the Baptist missionaries sent to India are critical of our government and its policies, that is not helpful. And as you, I know you know, Chad, that, you know, the mission work in the Caribbean was shut down because of the overly political atmosphere and all. So I think it was definitely both. But I think it was a sincerely held opinion. You shouldn't criticize in that kind of a high-handed manner, but he certainly didn't want to stir up any additional trouble. So, good question. Yes, sir. I think it was quite pronounced. Robert Hall had a sermon that was much more published and reproduced than Fuller's. It was written about the same time, preached about the same time. Quote, I think it was, the title of it was Sentiments Proper to the Present Crisis. Yeah, that's the name of it. And it echoes this theme of our guilt before God for national sins, and that our concern is not Napoleon and his military strength. We don't have to worry about Napoleon. He's only going to be successful against us if God allows him to, and hearkening back again to the biblical precedent in the Old Testament where God turned his people over. That seemed to be the great fear. I think it was very pronounced. And while other sins may be mentioned in terms of greed, oppression of the lower classes, the thing that certainly is on Fuller's mind, and I think on many other Baptists at the same time, was the issue of slavery. And they were, you know, very much open and out of the closet. It's sin. We're guilty before God. It's blood on our hands. We must repent. Yeah. I think we've lost, in Southern Baptist circles, we've lost a lot of the cautions, like I said, that are there against us, you know, us unhesitating, wrapping ourselves in flags and patriotism and all of that. I think Fuller did have more of a note of warning about that sort of thing. An enormous amount. In fact, the other section of this paper that needed to be here and was not would have been the influence of postmillennial thinking on how this whole war and event was interpreted in terms of the Fifth Monarchy kind of talk. There's a whole section there. In fact, I did a paper on postmillennial hermeneutics and the formation of the Baptist Missionary Society. There's much information here. Fuller's discourses on Genesis are filled with this information. There's a very fascinating note in there where in the first edition of the work, he had said some things about Rome has lost her head, Italy has become, quote, a Frenchified republic, all these words, and then, of course, he had to backtrack when Napoleon comes along and pulls back from the secularist, you know, position of the days of the revolution and kind of, you know, makes peace with the Catholicism and, you know, the Concordat and all of that. So he had to come back and say, well, maybe I was a little premature that Antichrist has been destroyed here as the Pope is, you know, now he's kind of back. But absolutely, it was a part of the context, and they spoke of it very often, and it's woven in there. He didn't in this particular sermon. His letters, his correspondence are filled with allusions to that and some of the published works, but really the correspondence. Definitely. Yeah, you know, Fuller is—he's a student of his age in terms of the Pope as Antichrist, as I think Keith mentioned. You know, that Luther taught us that we shouldn't differ. So, that was definitely his position.
Can I ask? Violate my position as moderator and ask a question that builds on that?
You probably already have exhausted my information, so I expect he knows more than I do. But go ahead. He mentions Bunyan in there one time, Bunyan's Holy War, but he doesn't,
yeah, but
not in the context at all of that, no.
No, is that where your question is leading? Is there still this concept among Baptists that somehow in waging war against the French, that they're engaged in some sort of religious crusade?
We've still got
that in the 1740s and 1750s with men like Joseph Stennett II. When he preaches, he gives Thanksgiving sermons for victories over, Bonnie Prince Charlie, the victories in the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War. But when you get, it strikes me when Baptists had their position as nonconformists, as a minority, has been so reconfirmed at the end of the century, they're no longer part of the Protestant interest. That does not. I've never really come across a hint of any sort of holy war in Robert Hall.
No.
Or Samuel Pierce. He preaches a Thanksgiving sermon, and he basically says there is no way we can gloat over the deaths of the French.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who does that is a cannibal.
Yep.
And Fuller is the same.
Same.
But if you go earlier in the century, men like Joseph Stennett the First, after the Battle of Blenheim, and the Second, after that I already mentioned, it's very clear for them. They're part of the Protestant establishment, and this is a holy war fighting the French.
Yeah, I see nothing in Fuller at all. Like you said, the only other thing to mention there is it's like to the extent that the postmillennial expectation is being worked out in the war against Napoleon and the way is being paved for the empire of Jesus to come in, it would have been that England is the unwitting tool of God in this. They're doing it, but nothing that they are to be commended, you know, because they're doing this knowingly. It's like, you know, Cyrus. Cyrus is not out to advance God's agenda intentionally. He's just God's unwitting instrument. I think that's how he would have viewed all of this unfolding. I think he did view that it was unfolding in a post-millennial sort of way, but he didn't see it as a doing it as a, quote, we're a Christian nation going to war to